Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program's been about the evolution of our consciousness, and that means who we are and our connections to others. I mean, we're not conscious if we're not really in relationship, and that's what tonight's program's all about. How do we develop healthy relationships with not just our intimate partners, but our friends, our family, our work relationships. So I'm very happy to be talking to the founder of the Relationship Foundation, Michael Jazz. Michael, good to have you here.
Good to be here.
You go into schools. I mean, I know Michael for a long, long time. He's actually one of my oldest and best friends, I would say, and we have a long history, and I've seen him evolve through this work, and it's incredible work because he's serving young people. I mean, we go to school for 12, 13 years, college, but we never learn about how to talk to each other. So the Relationship Foundation goes into high schools. They've been going to high schools in New York and hopefully around the country and teaching kids, young people, what a healthy relationship is. So let's start there. How do you define a healthy relationship?
Well, a healthy relationship is really based on communication, open and clear communication. Notice I don't say honest, because what's honest to some person might not be honest to another person. So being able to articulate your needs and feelings without blame and judgment is the basic element of what we teach. And also to listen empathically.
But, you know, I know it's based on the work of Marshall Rosenberg, nonviolent communication, which is a great, communication skills. But the problem I have with that is, let's say there's a disagreement and two people are in an argument. They're, I'm right, I'm right, that kind of argument. How do you get beyond that to come to that place of empathic, peaceful communication? How do you get there?
Well, arguments start as a result of two people with different strategies to meet their needs. Mm-hmm. So let's say both have a need for respect. Mm-hmm. One person's strategy is to joke about somebody in front of other people. And the other person's strategy is to speak in a way that doesn't include some kind of joking.
Right, defensive.
Sarcasm, snide remarks, right. Little jabs, and we do that quite a bit as part of our culture, the sarcasm. And in order for something like that to de-escalate and not escalate at all, both parties have to have a shared vocabulary of what their needs and feelings are. So when there's agreement to practice this relationship approach of needs and feelings, then you already are starting with a place where there's a knowing. Oh, well, we both know that we are people with needs and feelings, and take that into consideration. And something we pose to students as well as adults, because we work with the teachers as well, a simple question to ask ourselves, is this in my best interest?
Mm-hmm.
Does this need to be said?
Well, give me an example of what you mean. What kind of question would, or like if a kid wanted to join a gang, let's just use that, then it would be in their best interest because they would feel, they think they was, because I think we only do things that we think are in our best interest. There's companionship, there's community. Of course, it has its downside, but how do you talk about what is the highest for these young people?
We get them started thinking about relationships. They keep journals on how they see relationships portrayed in society, in the media, how they come to understand the relationships that they're closest with, family, friends, peers. So they keep these journals, and it really develops their critical thinking, so that they're starting to look at the way they speak, the way other people speak, and the thoughts that are going through their minds. And now they're looking at it in terms of the needs and feelings list. What am I needing? What am I feeling? So we know all the words in this needs and feelings list that we use. It's not something that you have to study 200 pages on the neuroscience of empathy and relating. It's a very simple approach.
Well, let's just back up a little bit, because I think people who may be new to this don't understand that I think you could even say the foundation of communicating with someone is to express your needs and your feelings. Would you say that?
It is if you learn about it, but most of us didn't learn that sort of thing. And our parents really didn't have access to this kind of information. It became more prevalent during the 60s and the 70s as modern psychology evolved. But needs, what are they? What are your needs in making this interview tonight?
Well,
connection, consciousness, awareness,
service,
community, self-expression. We're not taught to think in terms of what our needs are.
So, we don't even know we have needs. I mean, we don't even know that.
Well, we don't, because we're not exposed to the information. And so our parents didn't do anything wrong. Our teachers haven't done anything wrong. No one's to blame. Because until you have awareness about something, you really can't. How can you be expected to know what you don't know?
Right.
So, like, for instance, there's so much emphasis on significant other relationship. What are one's needs in a significant other relationship? People meet each other, they have chemistry, the chemicals are going for 6 months, a year, the chemicals wear off, and they say, well, what am I doing with this person? But if we were aware of the needs we had in a significant other relationship, we might not get involved in relationships that are not in our best interest. So what might be some of those needs be? Acceptance, affection, appreciation, care, closeness, belonging, consideration, inclusion, empathy, nurturing, love, partnership, companionship, respect. All of these are words that we already know.
Right, and we all need that. We all need those things.
Well, there's a value in being reminded about those words. So within our relationships, when these words become part of our vocabulary, so a friend says, you know, I just met this person, and I think this might be something that I want to keep pursuing. Mm-hmm. And so there would sort of already be kind of like a shared reality that you know each other is aware of these needs, and are these needs going to be met for the other for yourself? And I was about to say for the other person, because what we do in the classroom, we have kids write down what they want in a relationship. Oh, I want someone who likes foreign films, who likes literature. I like someone who I want someone who likes my music, and someone who likes to travel. And I want someone who would like a family, and I want someone who's funny. So these are these things that you want, and they write down what they want. And then we ask them, what do you want to give? Oh, when does anyone ever ask us that? Because we get together with our friends, especially those of us who are in our 30s and above, looking to meet someone, and we all talk about, well, I want someone who's this, and I want someone who's that. But what do we want to give? So we pose questions like this in the classroom to develop the critical thinking. What do we want to give?
What do people want to give? What's some of those answers for what people want
to
give?
They all write different things. So the kids will write things like, "Well, I want to have somebody's back. I want to be there for them. I want to show love. I want to express love. There's a variety of things that they come up with. But it's the question itself. What do you want, and what do you want to give?
So, I mean, just to like start, I mean, just to like get a sort of reference, you're bringing this to the school system, New York Board of Education, and this is revolutionary work, I think. No one's, I mean, people talk about this, but you're learning math and science. Is this a first? Talk about this inroad into education that you're making.
Well, there are various programs out in the world. In the States, they're referred to generally as social-emotional learning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's social-emotional learning? Do we have conversations about our social-emotional learning?
Yeah.
It's an academic term.
Right. And I don't know what you mean. I guess it means sort of what you're saying, but are there courses in this kind of stuff?
There are programs that are being introduced in different schools. They're called social-emotional learning. My social learning was in the home I grew up in, with my parents. My father was a workaholic. I hardly ever saw him. And my mother really wasn't doing that well, being alone so much. And so my social learning was limited. They also weren't very... they didn't have much of a social circle. So in terms of friendships, I wasn't observing how they built and developed friendships. So I had to learn that on my own. There are people who live a whole lifetime and say, I don't know how to make friends with people. So what is this social learning? Forget about what emotional learning is. A lot of us come from homes where the emotions are loud and yelling and screaming. And then some of us come from punishing silence. So what is emotional learning? What is social learning? It can be kind of difficult to figure that out. Whereas what we talk about is a need for relationship education.
Right. Of
we
course.
Think people in social emotional learning are doing great work, but we call it relationship education. So if I ask you what you think about relationship education, what you experienced growing up, what was your relationship education like? Well, you would talk about your home life, for starters, and maybe things that went on in school. But everything we learn, day in and day out, is our parents or guardian, whoever's there. And one of the things that I tell couples, because I also coach couples, is I say, your relationship is bigger than the two of you.
What do you mean? Isn't the relationship made of me and you, this and her, him and her, you know, how is it bigger than the two of us? I don't understand that.
If you have children, your children are watching mom and dad or mom and boyfriend or dad and girlfriend or mom and mom, dad and dad. They're watching how you interact. And so they start to emulate. Children emulate. And we learn very early patterns, impressions that we have about how the world is by watching the people that are bringing us up.
Exactly.
So therefore, your relationship is bigger than the two of you means how you treat each other is what your children are learning about relationships.
I mean, the only relationship education I had besides watching my parents is watching movies and thinking, you know, the idyllic couple, it has to be perfect like it is in movies. And I think that's been my problem, is that I have this idealistic understanding based on my relationship education that I didn't have except in film, that it's supposed to be like that. And I'm sort of programmed for that. And how do I get over that?
You get over it by, you're already getting it over by first asking yourself, how do I get over it?
Right.
The journey of 10,000 miles begins with a single step. So you've now said, how do I see beyond this? What is there for me besides father knows best or leave it to Beaver? these relationships didn't make much sense. Now, the other thing is they could take into consideration, as the women's movement began in the mid-60s and rolled with great force into the 70s and 80s, the divorce rate went through the roof.
Which was probably a good thing, though, because people were not happy and they did something about it. So I think divorce, you know, is great because, you know, you try out the... But you're not saying that. You're saying something else, right?
I think you just said it.
No. What are you saying?
Divorce is painful. It's painful for families. You may have heard about this website called Ashley Madison. It was a site where people could go and cheat who were married. It recently came down because some hackers thought it wasn't really a great idea to have a site like that out in the world. And they said, hey, take it down or release all the names. So they didn't take it down. They released all the names. One of the first schools that I was in was when the Ashley Madison was first being introduced. And there were ads in the back of our local papers here, the AM and the Metro paper, things that said life is short, have an affair. And the students are handed these papers as they get out of the subways and get off the buses. And so I saw a copy of the local paper on the desk of there were several kids were around the same desk. And so I asked them what they thought about this site. What do you think? And they wrote essays. And they wrote things about how disturbing it was to see a website making money off the pain and suffering a family's going through divorce. Mm. So divorce is not easy. Now, there are some divorces. Children have said, I'm so glad my parents split up because it was painful watching them be together. And there's other kids that thought they wish they had taken some steps to work things out. And then when children are much younger, they will often think a divorce is somehow their fault.
Right.
Dad's gone. Mom's gone. What did I do? I must have done something because the world's revolving around what they see and hear. And if suddenly someone is missing. So divorce is a very varied subject. We have a book. We wrote a book called Healthy Relationships 101. And you can read the first chapter on our website, therelationshipfoundation.org. A quicker route to that is trf.net. And we have a chapter in the book about divorce. It's only 4 pages long. One is by a talk that a judge gave to a couple in Minnesota. It was very striking how he said, if you start fighting for control of your kids, you will cut them in half. You will make their lives so miserable. And I'm not doing it justice, but we thought it was so eloquent we put it in the book. And the other story that we put in the book was about a young lady in Los Angeles whose parents split up, and she was at around age 13. So she was spending time at her father's home and then going to her mother's home and back and forth. And she joined a gang. And her mother started making a film about getting her back and out of the gang. And one of the things that she said that I will never forget, because I went to see the film and both the mother and the daughter were there, and the mother did get her out of the gang, but what the daughter said was, I'm never going to leave those people. I'm not going to be on the street with them, but they became my family. And the reason they became her family is because there was one culture at father's, one culture at mother's. And she said, I didn't know where I belonged, but in the gang, I knew that was home. And I was really struck by that.
It met her needs that she wasn't getting met at home.
Stability.
Yeah.
Certainty. Yeah, those are the needs of met. So everybody's got a different story. That's another thing that we say in the book. It's everyone has a different story. So we don't know why anyone does what they do until we get to know them. And you can keep getting to know someone and you'll get to know them forever. And that's part of the approach to developing friendships, is getting to know somebody but especially judging people that you just met. Have you ever been in a meeting or a social event, and you look at somebody and you go, no, don't want to meet them? You almost recoil.
I do that all the time.
And have you found that by chance you start talking to that person and you go, this is an amazing human being?
Yeah, that's happened to me. Yep. Yes.
If we could practice that. I mean, we're so wired to somehow, you know, want to create our little fence around our reality, and that certain people are going to be accepted and certain people aren't. I think it was Walt Whitman or some other well-known writer said, when you go to an event, look for the person that you least want to meet and go up to them because they have something for you.
Right, the repulsion. Yeah, I think that's good advice, because whatever's turning you off is definitely something you need to deal with. It's something, a part of us. It's
could be something about yourself that you don't like.
So when you go into a school, like a fresh school, what sort of like the first things, what would be your way of getting the kids' attention? And these are what, high school kids, right? And how do you get their, you know, focus?
The first session, which can go for many classes, is having the students write down their three top relationship questions. Mm-hmm. How do I get along better with my parents? Why do I hate my best friend? Sometimes girls write, why don't boys ever listen? What do you do? What do I do if I'm attracted to my friend? Their questions are extraordinary.
Right.
And whoever asks us to write down our relationship questions.
So
now, after they write the questions, then we say, now answer them. Because often we know the answers to our own questions.
They answer their own questions. That's really brilliant. That's really, really brilliant. And
sometimes
they
come up with an answer, sometimes they don't. Then we put them in pairs and have them discuss their questions with each other. And what happens is we say 1BA, 1B, 1BB. Mm-hmm. And A will share their questions. And B does a listening practice. Not only do they do a listening practice, but it's what's called a mirroring practice. So after A talks about their question, answer they could or couldn't get, B will say, well, if I understood you clearly, your question was dot, 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 dot. And mm-hmm. your answer was this. And
but is
A
that mirroring
say,
when you repeat someone's question? Is that what you're saying? Is that some mirroring?
We're having
process?
Them say, if I understood you correctly, your question was. And your answer was, did I get that?
Okay.
And can you imagine friends and couples really listening to each other and often mirroring back what they heard? And then the other person who has shared can say, well, you got that, but the part that you missed was, the answer that I came up with was, I have to give myself more consideration and give my, have a little more patience with my friend. So they say things like, well, you got that, but the part you missed, or you got most of it, but the other part was this. And the other person says, repeats that and says, thank you. And this simple exercise, which is an exercise that's taught by one of the most renowned relationship coaches, experts in the world, is Harville Hendricks. And I've studied his work. I coach couples, so I've studied his work and taken some advanced courses with him. And so this question is applied to the questions that kids come up with, but it's not specifically for significant other.
Oh, there's different questions you would ask a significant in relationship work.
In relationship work, what I do is recommend that if a couple wants to really study Harville Hendricks' work, there are certified imago therapists that are all over the world, and I recommend that. But what I do when I work with them individually is get them started in articulating their needs and feelings without blame and judgment. So, you didn't pick up the blinds when you said you would, and that really made me angry because I was doing all this work to get the room ready, and I just thought that was really selfish.
Uh-huh.
Nobody makes you anything.
I would say, I'm sorry, I'll get them now, or something like that, right?
Well, you might forget that now, but, you know, I'm sitting in a room, and it's a coaching session, so you can't go out and get the blinds. It's learning to say, when you didn't pick up the blinds, I felt really disappointed and anxious and frustrated because I have a need for consideration and understanding. And I love you. I love you so much. I don't want to shut down.
So you take response instead of saying, you did this to me, which is... This is really great. I mean, it's always good to review this. Instead of saying, you did this, you say, I felt this when this happened.
When? Right. I felt this when you did this or said that.
So I take responsibility for how I'm feeling. I'm not saying, you made me feel this. Right? I mean, that's key.
Well, barring physical abuse and... In your younger physical or emotional abuse in your younger years. But once we get out in the world, once we're out of school, whether it's high school or college, whatever, other people are going to say and do things that we won't always appreciate. But blaming them, making them wrong, judging them, shaming them, does not create connection.
Mm-hmm.
If I tell you what I think you're doing that's wrong in the world and wrong with me and why you'll never be a person that people can trust, how does that feel when you hear someone say something like that to you?
Well, it doesn't make me feel good, you know, so... But that happens all the time. That's the relationship education people get. You know, that's
well,
the problem.
In our friendship, I think we used to get into that a bit, but...
Yeah, I think we were sarcastic with each other.
The last couple years, that's fallen away.
We still have a little sarcasm in our dialogues.
Tell me more.
You're just using tell you more?
So the reason I said that, and I'm laughing, is... we have an empathy practice.
Okay.
And empathy is...
Define empathy, because I think that's a word people don't even know what that means.
The dictionary definition of empathy is to be able to understand the feelings of another person.
Mm-hmm.
How can you understand the feelings of another person unless they tell you what they're feeling? You can guess what they're feeling. You can say, I'm wondering if you're feeling. I'm guessing you might be feeling. Those are called empathy guesses. Has anyone ever said, you know, Alan, you seem really angry right now, and you weren't angry? Then did you get angry when they told you you were angry?
Yeah, I'd get angry if they said that to me.
Well, because they're telling you how you're feeling. So one of the things we look at is empathy guesses, but... The dictionary definition is misleading. Mm-hmm. What we do is we say when someone says, let's say they had a really tough day, the traffic was so thick and their lunch was not very tasty and my boss was really in a bad mood. And we'll listen to people say things like that, and then we'll often do what we call empathy blocking. Say, you had a bad day. Oh, me too. Let me tell you about my day. Has that ever happened? Someone immediately launches into what's going on with them?
So when that happens, I'm not able to really... Why do we do that? Why do we do... Well, maybe we do it to make them feel better. You had a bad day,
well,
I had a worse day.
If you told me how aggravated you are by the elevators in a building I was in, and then I say, oh, yeah, these elevators really bug me, too. Well, you think you might be empathizing with them, but maybe they didn't want to hear what you have to say about elevators. Maybe they simply wanted to be heard. So let me just run through this list of one-upping. You had a bad day. Let me tell you about mine. You know, Alan, there's a good book you can get on time management, and they also have a lot about how to plan your day when you're traveling to work. Educating. Alan, I think maybe if you got to sleep a little earlier, you might not hit that kind of traffic.
Wait,
advising.
So you're saying these are negative response. These are not these do not help when you. These are not empathic responses. Because somebody might think they are. Oh, you have a problem sleeping? Get this book. But you're saying that's in the way of empathy.
Right. It's one-upping, educating, fixing. Alan, you know, this has become a pattern of yours, analyzing. All right, Alan, the day's over, so just relax, forget about it. Discounting, consoling. We don't realize that we're doing one-upping, educating, fixing, discounting, analyzing, consoling, because that's what goes on in our culture. What we practice is simply saying, I hear you.
So when someone is heard, they're able to at least have some relief from their pain, right? Is that the idea? They, instead of fixing it, which doesn't really help them in the moment, hearing somebody is making that connection, and there's a release of some. Oh, someone heard me. Someone can feel what I'm feeling. Oh, that eases something when you say that. Yeah.
It seems to be the case. To simply say, I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
Your sister calls you up and says, my kids are, you know, getting into a lot of trouble and they're not eating. And one of them, I got to take one to the doctor. And you say, I hear you. Or you might say, tell me more. But you mean it. Tell me more. How often does somebody say, tell me more?
Never, but because our immediate response is to fix. Oh, your kid's having problems. I know someone that can help.
Oh, yeah. That's a good book you can read about measles. Let me order it for you on Amazon.
Well, because we think we're helping that way, but you're saying we're not actually helping.
Well, in general, I can't say that it's not always going to benefit, but in general. Let's look at the pattern. Let's practice saying, I hear you.
Yeah, I think
depending on the person who they are in your life, tell me more. And in cases where someone tells you about something that's maybe tragic or very, very hurtful, something happened, you can say, I really don't know what to say. I'm just so glad you told me.
Mm.
And then silence. Watch what happens to that person's face. Feel what you feel over the phone. I really don't know what to say, but I'm just so glad you told me.
Yeah, that actually feels good. It does really feel, wow, it actually feels like someone's with me. When I hear that, it's like, oh, you're with me. I'm not alone in my stuff. Yeah.
They're glad
that.
You told them. They love you. They care for you.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, have you ever been in a situation and someone tells you about something that sounds so difficult and you want to say, well, that's too bad. That's too bad in your head. And do they need to hear that it's too bad? Do they need to hear you pile on what's already unpleasant? So another thing that we consider, Alan, is about relationships. Is the word practice. You want to get good at an instrument, what do?
Practice, yes.
You want to get good at a language?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do you practice this stuff?
Well, who ever heard of a relationship practice?
Well, what would that be? What does that look like?
That's what we've been doing on this call.
Oh, we've been
talking about relationship practices.
Maybe we'll get along better. Yes.
Yes, I hope we will.
Yeah. No, because you've been...
Alan, excuse me. Tell me more.
Oh, okay. Thank you. But a practice...
Now, here's the thing about empathy. It becomes very humorous. Mm-hmm. So just in this moment, maybe we'll get along better. And instead of defending, and I say, well, Alan, aren't we getting along better? Come on, after all, blah, blah, blah. I say, tell me more.
Right.
And I don't think you really are going to tell me more, but it becomes funny. But and it's something you have fun with.
You know, there's one other key to empathy is what I learned when I studied with one of Marshall Rosenberg's people. If no one's around to give you, if something happens and you really feel bad about it, you can give yourself empathy. Do you deal with self-empathy at all?
We do a bit, but by being able to identify what your needs and feelings are, that's the beginning of self-empathy. Oh, wow, I'm really feeling worried and confused. I have a need for clarity and effectiveness and efficiency. And we won't have our files in on time for the report we have to submit tomorrow. So thinking about your needs and feelings is the beginning of self-empathy. But we don't go into it in the schools. We start with being able to articulate needs and feelings without blame and judgment and to listen empathically and to learn to make requests instead of demands.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. And like they say, you cannot make a request unless you first shared your needs and feelings. That's what I've learned about that. Is that true?
That makes sense for the most part.
If I say shut the window, it's like you're demanding something. But if I say, you know, I'm really feeling cold and I have a need, you know, for more comfort, do you mind if you shut the window? Something like that. You know, that's
one way to make a request.
How would you make a request?
Well, that's just the way you did it. That's a simple request.
Are there other ways to make a request?
You have a need for comfort.
Right. But you share your needs and feelings about your request, would you say?
Right. I mean, in a way, this language is very clunky to begin with. But after a while, it's like practicing. So when you first put your hands on a violin, what's it sound like in lesson one?
Yeah, I get it.
Right, it's clunky. But by practicing this clunky sort of language, after a while, it sort of evolves into a normal way of speaking. And there's a sort of a really shared reality. The more the kids in the classroom, the teachers we work with, we just did a training for 65 tutors and teachers in Harlem a couple weeks ago. And they were amazed to see how simple this work is, the very things we're speaking about tonight. They're now going to be going into the classrooms and imparting this to the students they work with.
Well, what has been the reaction among, has this been like a revelation among these kids that you've been working? What's some of the reactions you get from these students?
We see a lot of different reactions, but for the most part, we collect evaluations from them after we're done with the course. Mm-hmm. We teach it at different levels, or different amounts of days. But they all say the thing that made the biggest impact on them was learning about needs and feelings. And one student in particular comes to mind who wrote, "I didn't realize other people had feelings."
Wow, that's amazing.
I didn't know people had feelings growing up. I mean, I thought people cry and they laugh. I didn't know that those were feelings, and I didn't know I had feelings.
Wow.
Here in this day and age, the word feelings is a lot more out in the culture. But yeah, that student said it made me realize other people have feelings.
That's incredible. That's so. I think you're doing an amazing thing. I wish I had something like relationship education and when I was in high school at least. But what's your big vision? What's your big mission? What do you want to accomplish, you know, worldwide? What do you see?
Well, our mission is to really spread the use of the needs and feelings, expressing them without blame and judgment, and to make relationship education a component of the learning process. And where things have led us at this point is that we had a meeting with an executive at Scholastic, the well-known magazine in schools everywhere, and we now have a letter of agreement with them as well as a PowerPoint about getting our work out to schools around the country. And we are looking for a corporate sponsor. So if you know of, let's say, Office Max or Staples, or it could even be a computer company that wants to have their brand next to the Scholastic brand to bring relationship education out into the U.S. learning system, let us know.
Wait, what would a corporate sponsor do? They put up money for you to do what? What do you need?
They would put up funds to print and distribute the curriculum and to develop video lessons and online lessons.
Uh-huh. So right now, how many schools are you in New York City?
We've been in 16 schools.
That's pretty
amazing. We have several schools that we're speaking to. And at the moment, we only go into them one at a time because we don't have a big staff. So that's it. One of the other reasons that we're seeking funding is to develop more training programs for teachers and also training the trainers.
Wait, so how do you get into a school? You talk to a principal and they give you what, an hour a week? How's that set up been?
Yeah, it's one class period a week. We've been, each school we go into is a different time frame. The first school I was in, I was there every day, three classes a day with an entire sophomore class. That was the very first school I went into where I was building and developing the curriculum. The next school was every day.
How was that for
you? That was a tremendous learning experience and a lot of work.
I see. Okay.
We saw kids... the kids had so much interest in this subject that we kept going.
Wow. Nice. And how do you get into a school though? What's like the who do you need to meet to get into a high school?
You generally have to meet the principal because the principal makes decisions about any new programs.
I see.
That's who it starts with. But we're in touch with several superintendents, one in particular in the Bronx that's interested in our program. And if the superintendent says, bring it in, that probably will instigate more schools to take it.
Well, can you go directly to the New York City Board of Education and say, hey, this would be something that would cut down on, you know, some of the problems that you have in schools?
We're reaching out to the Board of Ed. It's challenging to get through, but we're reaching out to as many people as we can. We've had a meeting with the Chief of Staff of Council Member Corey Johnson on the west side of Manhattan, and he sent out an email on behalf of the councilman to the high schools in the district. And at the moment, there's so much emphasis on math and science and history and test scores.
Right.
And principals don't necessarily think that relationship education is going to improve English, math, science test scores. But what happens is if you improve behavior, you naturally improve the grades.
That's a really good point.
And so we're more and more getting through to schools. And what's also been very gratifying is people are finding us now on the internet. They are doing a word search for healthy relationships. We're getting emails and calls from mental health clinics, hospitals, rehab centers. Other colleges, professors. I'd like to find out more about what you're doing. This is so important. We've never met anyone who hasn't responded very favorably to a card we give. And we have a card, and our business card says, we spend at least 12 years preparing for a career. How much time do we spend preparing for a relationship? Any relationship.
Right.
Because you see, if I ask you how many people you know, well, let's say somebody else, the average person, they might say, because you know thousands of people, but right. The average person say, oh, yeah, I know a couple hundred people.
Yeah.
We say, do you have a different relationship with each one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so are you in a relationship? We don't say, what do you mean? I know like 200 people. I have a different relationship with all of them. Somehow, are you in a relationship has come to mean significant other.
Right.
Walk past the newsstand. What do you see? Celebrities this, celebrities that. Politicians, scandals. This one's getting divorced. This one's getting married. And so much, there's so much emphasis. Bachelors, bachelorettes, the TV shows. So much is centered on significant other that we tend to think the word relationship means just that. But relationships are your whole world.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, we're all in relationship with each other, everyone. But so what would your ideal, what do you want? What would your, you know, if you could be part of the school system, what would a program like this look like?
It would start in pre-K.
Okay.
Kids would start to learn to build a vocabulary of needs and feelings and to be able to say, when someone has a difficult day, I hear you. And they would practice that day in and day out. And then they would do the same in first grade and second grade. But then the second graders would mentor the first graders. And as this built through the grades, kids would start mentoring each other. And by the time we get to middle school, we're looking at how to have healthy relationships in relation to subjects such as self-esteem and body image, the effect of the media, how to detect and avoid abusive situations, the excessive use of technology. We have entered a very, in many ways, of sort of very frightening world as we're losing contact with each other, voice to voice and face to face. There's a huge article in the Sunday Times by Sherry Turkle, a well-known relationship expert, and also who writes extensively on technology.
And what does she say?
She's saying, in so many eloquent words, I hardly remember any of it, other than spend more time voice-to-voice and face-to-face or you will lose touch with the human race and your humanity.
Right. I know. I was just at this bar the other day. I was giving someone a massage. This hacker guy got very upset because I was making physical contact. It was just so odd, this person's reaction. Obviously spends too much time on the computer. I was just, you know, it's so strange that people have forgotten that we're there to actually, we're embodied physical beings. I mean, I don't know. I just thought, you know, we need to remember that we're physical and not just on computers. I mean, that's, you know, it's great
to
have.
We do not, we don't go there. We don't talk about, one of the needs we have is for touch, but we don't go into that, Alan.
Right.
We're looking at practicing relationship dynamics.
Right, and so we're not talking about physical.
We have a chapter on boundaries.
All sometimes right, thank people, you for telling me. People, thank you, Michael. I'm thanking you for reminding me of that. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things we looked at. Is it okay for this person to put their arm around my shoulders?
Right, so talk about boundaries. I mean, that's probably something I do need to know more about. What do you mean by boundaries?
It's reviewing what your needs are around the words that you speak, the words that other people speak. Touch is one of them. Someone says, you know, can I hold your hand?
Right.
No, I'd rather you didn't do that. But I'm enjoying spending time with you. Maybe another time. But,
although some women might not even realize what their needs. I mean, that's been, you know, a problem, especially with women, understanding their needs and thinking they have to do something because someone asked them. And, you know, I think that's been a big problem in our culture.
Well, we have a real crisis with sexual assault and sexual harassment at every age.
That's true.
And
is this helping? Is these relationships helping that kind of crisis?
Well, when we teach critical thinking, empathy, and respect, and that becomes part of how you view the world and view other people, we believe it'll help. We don't have the funds to do longitudinal studies at this point, but we hope to have it. But you could really track people for a lifetime and not exactly know what the outcome is of relationship education, because people have deep-seated issues, and you would need to put a psychologist on to each and every person, and it's not realistic. But what we're seeing in the classroom is we're seeing kids transformed in how they relate to each other and with each other.
Well, I think it's a great idea to go into kindergarten and start there. But at this level, how many different lessons do you have? And what would you like to do with just high schools? Go in and have like a ongoing course? Or how do you see it happening now?
It happens at various levels.
Well, what would you like?
A teacher can take the first lesson. What are your top three relationship questions? The teacher could spend weeks discussing the questions that the kids have and the answers they could or couldn't come up with.
Right.
And so we really want the teachers to put this into their own voice. And then the things the kids write in their journals. We have a journal entry before each chapter in our book. And it's striking what these young people are writing. I want to read you one. In a charter school I was at in Queens, there was an 11th grade class. We had 55 kids in our classroom, and they were, these kids were excused from their SAT literacy prep class to come into our class because they were writing so much about relationships, and they are more interested in writing about relationships than they are about the War of 1812.
Wow.
No offense if you're a...
No, I think it's right.
But I want to read what one 11th grade boy wrote. Very short. What honestly is love? Is it an emotion, feeling, or an action? I feel that as human beings, our biggest necessity is companionship and to be loved and give love. We are strange, affectionate creatures, always trying to express emotions for one another in a variety of ways. I believe our affectionate emotions spawn from the greatest thing humans have, understanding. We want to understand others and be understood.
Wow, that guy's a genius. Who is that kid?
16 years old.
That's a talent. He's very...
He got to write. Yeah.
That's really great. Wow.
Yeah.
That guy's a leader, whoever he is.
They're writing some very moving things. Do I have time to read one more?
Yeah, I love this stuff. This is we can go over an hour. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, let me read this last one, and then let's end on that, and then let's recap. A song that I wrote, Drift Slowly, has a lot of emotion in it. Between the flow of the music and the lyrics, my story is told. While I wrote this song, I was thinking about how I may have hurt people who are close to me. So I want to let them know the truth within me. Lyrics. The water from my eyes, it was never meant to drown you. The fire in my soul was never meant to burn you. The dagger in my tongue never meant to strike. And when I push you away, I'm asking you to hold on tighter every day.
Wow. These people are very talented at expressing deep, deep stuff. So you have a book out now, and the book is called?
Healthy Relationships 101. Mm-hmm. And you can download it off the internet for $2.99.
Wow.
We want to make it affordable. And also something else about our book, Alan. There's not one word in it that a parent with just average reading skills would have to look up in a dictionary, because we wanted to make it accessible, especially to parents.
So how many actual lessons have you laid out? You have the empathy lesson, the boundary. How many of those in your classroom work do you have, you know, laid out?
Well, we start with our first lesson is called The Journey Begins. And that's right. Where we do the three relationship questions and the journal assignment and get them going with that. So that's session one. Session two, three, and four. First one is needs in a relationship, needs and feelings, the application of effective communication. Session five is empathy. But all of these can be built out for weeks and weeks on end. You cannot learn empathy in 39 minutes.
Right.
I take that back. Some people can. I just made a judgment. I made a generalization. But if I'm going to learn to practice empathy and talk about what it means to me and be able to express myself in the class and have the teacher express themselves and get the kids to open up. In fact, when we did the lesson on self-esteem and body image, in the school where I, on 15th Street that I was in every day for an entire semester.
Wow.
We had a student, her name was Maria, and I'm always in the classroom with another teacher. She came up to us after that we began this lesson, and she said, please don't call on me, because we had called on her and we call on different kids. She said, please don't call on me. I have no self-esteem. My family treats me so poorly, and I don't want to have to talk in this class. We said, okay. By the middle of the next class, by respecting her wishes, her boundaries, her needs and feelings, whose hand was shooting up for the rest of the course? Maria's.
That must have changed your life, I would say.
I felt very grateful. Well, the feelings that I have about doing this are that I feel moved, I feel grateful, I feel hopeful. I feel hopeful. This is what gets me up in the morning. And it meets my need for purpose and community and participation.
Right.
And self-expression.
Right, right. So I'm just curious about the body image class. What needs are being met or not being met if, like, young people have to, you know, create a certain body type? How do you work needs and feelings into body image?
We look at the effect of the media and the kinds of advertisements that are out there, especially for women, and a lot of those advertisements are, you're only as good as you are thin. There's even something called thinspiration. And the image we have, the so-called beautiful girl or woman, is someone who's thinner than 98% of the population. Who is out there in the fashion world? Who are the gods of the fashion world that say, we want women to fit into clothes that most of the population can't fit into?
Right.
Who are these people? And these are discussions that come up in the classroom. And so, well, I want somebody, you know, who's really, you know, has that nice shape that we'll get boys, especially, you know, I want somebody who looks, you know, I don't want anybody who's not really thin. I said, so suppose you meet someone who is your physical ideal, thin face that you find appealing, all that. That'll be great, right? Yeah, that'll be great. I want that kind of girl. I said, so you fall in love with them, they fall in love with you. It's really great, right? Yeah, it's great. What if she gets in an accident, loses her leg? Are you leaving or are you staying? Oh, well, I'm staying. You know, I'm going to be in there through thick and thin. So then the physical attributes aren't always necessarily so crucial. Let me think about that. Boom! Their critical thinking goes into motion.
I see.
But we challenge them to think about these things. Okay. So the photoshopping that's used to make women thin. If you look at so many ads, women's faces are photoshopped so there's no freckles or scars or a blemish. And there's no pores.
Right.
I don't want to meet someone that's got no pores because their skin can't breathe. I mean, it's become, Alan, it's just become, I don't know how to describe it without making a judgment. I find it distressing, so I'm not going to make a judgment.
Right.
Why should girls and women be subjected to the messages the fashion industry has for them?
Well,
aren't
I don't know
they
why
good enough the way they are?
I don't know why it exists, but it does. So all we could do is educate people not to fall into those traps, I guess. You know?
That's what we're doing. That's where the discussions that are built around critical thinking.
Wait,
bullying.
One more thing I want to ask you about is this bully prevention. And what does that mean, bully? You can prevent people from being bullied, from bullying, because that's big these days.
When you start to see people as people with needs and feelings instead of your judgments,
right?
Why would you bully someone if you're not judging them as not good enough or too small or too tall to be around? A bully has needs also. They have needs for understanding. They have needs for awareness. They have needs for respect. And their strategy to meet their needs often has a consequence. You can scar somebody for life. Mm. In fact, in my book, Alan, I write about when I was in sixth grade, there was a girl from, I guess we could say, the other side of the tracks. Yeah. And her clothes were dirty.
Right.
She had some of her teeth were rotting.
Right.
And I don't remember, and the kids made fun of her. And by the way, making fun isn't fun.
No, it's not. It's not.
And then, and I don't remember whether I was unkind to her or I stood by.
Well,
I'm
pretty sure I
was glad they weren't picking on me because I got picked on. But I didn't stand up for her. And in my book, I wrote her a letter of apology. I tried to find her on the internet 40 years later to say, I'm sorry. So when you bully someone, whether you're 5, 10, 17, any age, it stays in your psyche. And one day you wake up and you go, oh no, what was I doing? Because on one level, we know that hurting people has a consequence.
Right.
And it came back to haunt me 40 years later.
Wow. So this is amazing work. It really, really is. And, you know, if we only had this, we'd all be in better relationships with not just our intimate partners, but with, you know, there'd be less war, there'd be less crime, there'd be less violence. You know, it's all the things that are the problem. This is essential, I feel, for everyone to have this knowledge.
Well, that's how we see it, and it's really great to discuss this with you. It meets my need for shared reality.
Well, good. And if I'm meeting your needs, my needs are getting met too. You know, before we'd have strategies to meet our needs, but is strategies necessary if you are expressing your needs, or strategies a indirect way to get your needs met?
Well, there's always a strategy for every need.
Uh-huh.
So if, let's say you're driving down the highway and somebody cuts you off. Do you roll down your window and say, you know, that didn't meet my need for safety and stability?
Right.
No. You idiot! And dare I say, words get spoken that we won't speak on this show. But do we wonder, I wonder if that person is on their way to pick up their child.
Maybe there's an emergency.
Right. The lights went off. Soccer practice is over. And that person is very worried, very tense, and they weren't paying attention. And maybe that same person works in a hospital and helped to save somebody's life 25 minutes ago. And maybe they raised $5,000 for a homeless shelter.
Right.
Are they an idiot? Or are they someone whose strategy to meet their needs included cutting you off? You didn't appreciate their strategy, but they're not an idiot, are they? Huh. So thinking about things like that, you don't always appreciate somebody's strategy to meet their needs, but they're not your judgments.
Right, right. No, I think that's important, so thank you. No, that's... I mean, we could talk on and on. I mean, we could do the whole course here, you know?
It makes life a lot easier when you start to work on... And, you know, for you and I, we have a lifetime of baggage. We have a lifetime of programming. But in high schools, in middle school...
Are you sure I have a lifetime of baggage and programming, or are you projecting that on me?
Well, that was a guess.
Okay. I might. I'm going to look into... I'm sure I do have some...
Well, I do. I do. And I'm in the process of unlearning. As I get this out in the world and teach it, it is becoming an unlearning for me, and it's made life much easier.
Yeah, I'd love for you to come into this adult education class. Do you teach adults too?
Same issues we're talking about for students are the same that I have as an adult. So I'm happy to speak with other people my own age or any age.
No, I think it, I think it's great. I mean, I hope you are in every single school in New York to start with. I think, you know, I think it would be hugely effective. I think, you know, I think the New York Times should do like a little spread article about you and, you know, start to educate people about what's possible.
We would love to have more and more publicity about this. We'd love to have 10 million moms on, for relationship education on Facebook.
Mm. All right, so they can find you on Facebook under Relationship Education?
The Relationship Foundation, that's our, we have a Relationship Foundation Facebook page where we post articles about empathy and other social issues. And then our website is trf.net. And we have another radio interview on our homepage. We also have a one page on empathy. People can download the needs and feelings list and start practicing that with each other.
And what's the purpose of keeping a journal? How do you suggest keeping a journal?
We have students keep journals on how they see relationships portrayed in society, in the media, their own particular experience with relationships. There was one journal entry that it's coming to mind now about a girl in a senior class. We had, she kind of came out of this tough attitude. And she wrote about how she was on the subway and she saw some guy with his finger in his ear, flicking around there. And that the subway jerked and the guy grabbed for the pole in the process, he brushed her arm. And she said, well, what I did was I rushed home and I washed my arm. And normally I would have given him a piece of my mind. But I really thought, I stopped and thought, well, I guess he had a need for safety and stability, but I didn't appreciate his strategy to keep his hygiene in order. Right. And that's a tough kid who's rethinking what would normally have triggered her. There's
nice.
So many examples that we have. We have some posted on the website. We have some there in our book. It's really endless because each kid has a different viewpoint and each kid is learning how to see the world different than their judgments and evaluations, and their life gets easier.
So every day they keep this journal to just keep track of their...
They have to put two journal entries together per week. It's a writing assignment.
I see.
They can write more if they want to. Some kids did write more.
So would you like to be in a school like all year round, like the full, like, you know, two semesters for a class? Would that be an ideal sort of situation as well?
We'd like this to become as important as health ed and phys ed. We'd like it to become relationship education to be a component of the learning process. How schools build it and schedule it is up to each school individually. But have it become... It's time for the four R's. Mm-hmm. Reading, writing, arithmetic, and relationships.
Great.
Build it into your curriculum.
That's a really good slogan, the four R's. That's really great. You should use that one. That's really that will get it in there. Good. No, I always enjoy hanging out, talking, learning. Thank you for this opportunity to share your passion with your life's work, really, the way you serve the community. So I've been talking to Michael Jazz, the founder of the Relationship Foundation. That's trf.net. And if you're influential in any school districts, he is available to go in and start teaching relationship education. Any final words, Michael?
I'm grateful to have had some time on your show because sometimes when we speak over the radio, it's T as in Tom, R as in Robert, F as in Francisco, trf.net. And you can write to us there, info@trf or michael@trf. And really appreciate it, Alan.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.
Very good.
All right, bye. Thanks. See you soon. Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you are interested in more programs about not just these subjects, but the whole realm of consciousness, look at my website, newrealities.com. You can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening.